This week on COVID, Race, and Democracy.
Google has made it impossible, and Amazon as well, has made it impossible for workers at these companies to stay on the sidelines. In essence, we've been conscripted into the IDF's war.
Google workers demand that Google cancel its Nimbus project contract with Israel.
Proud Boys was major in Chile. It was called Fatherland and Liberty. And the CIA, AFIELD, and the International Trade Secretariat completely funded it. Where is the solidarity in that?
We hear from labor historian Ruth Needleman on the 49th anniversary of the 9/11 Chilean coup.
It was so bad a week or so ago that buildings with like a second or third floor didn't have enough water pressure to flush your commodes. In fact, the state capitol has got porta potties around it.
In Mississippi, workers fight for clean water and against union busting.
Two agents of U.S. Empire, Paul Kagame of Rwanda, Yoweri Museveni of Uganda, they've been able to pretty much have their way in the Congo, the Great Lakes region of Africa, and East Africa, and the Horn of Africa for that matter, for the past quarter century. And the United States blocks any attempt to hold them to account or to bring them to justice.
Rwanda and Uganda's infamous M23 militia has reappeared in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. This week, Google workers and other tech workers and activists rallied in San Francisco, Seattle, and Durham, South Carolina, to demand that Google cancel Project Nimbus, its $1.5 billion contract with Israel, to control and spy on the Palestinian population. Pacifica covered the rally at Google and Amazon headquarters in San Francisco.
I'm Josh Markson. I'm a software engineer in cloud, Google Cloud, and also an organizer with Alphabet Workers Union. The Alphabet Workers Union is the union of Google workers. We're a wall-to-wall union, so we organize workers at Google, at other bets underneath Alphabet, and also temps, contractors, and anyone who works in that Google ecosystem.
Subcontractors too?
Yes, that's right.
You decided that you're going to support this. What is it all about?
One, our company has chosen to tie a significant portion of its revenue to Israeli apartheid. We've learned through recent journalism that Google Cloud products are going to be used by the Israeli Defense Force. And some of the reporting has really concerning implications for how it's going to be used. In particular, we're really worried that the existing surveillance network that the Israeli Defense Force maintains over most Palestinian territories is going to be augmented with our technology, making it that much more efficient and intelligent. Also, when workers like Ariel Koren have spoken out, raising their concerns about this, and other workers as well, They've been retaliated against, and Arielle last week was pushed to resign due to her concerns. So we're here to show support for Arielle, to show support for the workers who have these concerns. Many other workers have reported less severe but still unsettling interactions with HR for things as innocuous as identifying as Palestinian American.
Well, IBM in the 40s was involved in providing technology to the Germans, the Nazis, which was used to identify Jews, and apparently they made a lot of money off it. I mean, it seems like morality has very little to do with companies these days.
Google released, in the wake of organizing by employees in 2018 against the Maven contract, that they had these AI principles. And among those principles, it said we would not work in applications that would do harm, that would surveil in violation of international norms. And this contract, the fact that we're willing to take this contract shows that one way or another, we're not sticking to these principles, at least not the spirit of the principles. So absolutely, yeah, I think Google's actions speak louder than their words, and yeah, they're choosing profit over human rights.
What can people do about this?
Contact Alphabet Workers Union. There's a website called notechforapartheid.com that has a lot more information.
My name is Ray. I'm a software engineer at Google and a member of the Alphabet Workers Union. And I'm here today because I believe I have a moral obligation to speak out against Project Nimbus and condemn the surveillance and oppression of Palestinians that Google technology would facilitate through this contract with the Israeli military. I'm horrified at the idea of Google technology being used to enable apartheid and settler colonialism, and I strongly believe we cannot uphold our mission of respecting our users when we are allowing our work to be used to surveil Palestinians and force them off their land. I'm so grateful for Arielle and all the Google workers who have risked retaliation to speak out against Project Nimbus, and I'm grateful to be here in solidarity with tech workers at Google, Amazon, and beyond who are refusing to uphold apartheid with the technology we build. I truly believe that our unity as workers is the key to making meaningful change, and that with collective action, we can stop Google from pursuing military contracts with Israel and beyond. It was Polaroid worker solidarity in action that stopped Polaroid from enabling South African apartheid in 1970. It was international dock worker solidarity that helped halt South African apartheid. It was Google worker solidarity in action that helped stop Google's Department of Defense AI contract through Project Maven. And today, I believe Google and Amazon worker solidarity in action can stop our companies from enabling Israeli apartheid and instead build technology that will serve and uplift our users.
By taking this contract, given the ever-strengthening consensus that the Israeli occupation of Palestine is an international crime, given that the IDF currently maintains one of the world's most comprehensive automated surveillance systems over all of Palestine, 24/7, and given recent journalism exposing strong suggestions that our products will be integrated into these surveillance systems, making them that much more efficient and intelligent. Google has made it impossible, and Amazon as well, has made it impossible for workers at these companies to stay on the sidelines. The Nimbus contract is structured such that all sectors of the Israeli government, including the IDF, must get access to our products. In essence, we've been conscripted into the IDF's war. By showing up here today, workers of all backgrounds are saying that we will not abandon the responsibility to ensure that the technologies that we build will be used responsibly, even if leadership has abandoned that responsibility. We will not be complicit in ongoing dehumanization, subjugation, and displacement of millions of innocent people. We see through the divide and conquer tactics. We're not going to fall for it. And we won't let coworkers facing repression in our workplace or in their homelands be singled out to face it alone. For every worker speaking here today, hundreds more are standing behind them. We rallied behind Arielle, and we will rally again if Google decides to retaliate further against our coworkers.
Josh, Project Nimbus crosses a line that Israel's occupation of Palestine is demonstrably apartheid. And I think Google was built on stronger ideals than they're showing today.
And you're concerned about how it's going to be used?
Yes, absolutely. My work will be used to persecute and oppress. I can't let that happen.
That was a San Francisco rally against Google's Project Nimbus contract with Israel. This week is also the 49th anniversary of the September 11th coup in Chile, which was organized by the U.S. and the AFL-CIO's American Institute for Free Labor Development. Labor historian and Indiana University professor emeritus Ruth Needleman was in Chile 6 months prior to the coup. She spoke with Pacifica.
What happened in Chile couldn't have happened if the United States was not directly overwhelmingly involved. And that along with that, the AFL-CIO was instrumental in destroying Chile's unions and replacing them with professional organizations that supported U.S. corporations and who wanted to bring down Allende and were tied in with the counter-revolutionaries. And so our money, our resources were used to kill workers, our own unions. Some of them, not too many, were aware and fought it, very few. Some were aware and supported it in the name of fighting communism, which has been the target that has shaped the US labor movement into a fairly reactionary global force. And I hate to say that, I love the labor movement. It's been part of my life. My father was a typesetter and was a union man. And I work with the farm workers. I've taught labor studies for almost 40 years. But our unions were instrumental in overthrowing Allende so that US corporations, most of whom would not deal with unions in this country, could get back to exploiting the workers in Chile and taking all the money out of Chile when they took all their copper. And so we're involved, whether we want to be or not. Now, the question really is, why is it relevant? You know, okay, so our government and even our unions did terrible things, but this is 2022. I think looking at the rise of fascism in Chile, which, by the way, the design of it came from Kissinger. And so the design of it is being replayed right now in the United States. How do you bring fascism to power in a democracy? Remember, Chile was the most stable government in Latin America. They hadn't had coups and uprisings. I mean, it had been a stable democracy. People voted. They might like or dislike, but, you know, the military was not in control. And we've never had a military takeover. Not that I think that's the probable thing that might happen here. But the important thing is that right-wing forces cannot destroy popular movements unless they can neutralize the middle sectors. In other words, if small business owners and professionals and engineers can see their interests as bringing down the autocracy or bringing down the powerful elite. But what happened in Chile, it was so structured, so well played out. And I'm afraid we're seeing it in this country. Let me begin. The first thing the US did was just try to get a little push. That's like a military seizure. They had some isolated guy in the military kill the chief of staff who supported Allende. It was a total blunder. It was a US coup attempt without any widespread Chilean support. Didn't work. Then they started to make a plan. You have to get the people on your side. And big corporations can't get the people on their side unless they change the playing field. So my favorite example has to do with El Mercurio. Was the major right-wing newspaper. The president was a vice president of Pepsi-Cola in this country. He was a paper company. He not only made newspapers, he was the sole producer of toilet paper. And most middle sectors did not hate Allende when he came in. It took a plan, a lot of misinformation, but then a strategy. And so what they started doing was hoarding everything. The U.S. shipped nothing in, no spare parts, all this stuff. And in a way, this problem with getting our materials today is creating shortages, not unlike the ones we experienced. I mean, they're not as strategic yet, but that baby formula thing was pretty bad. But in Chile, what happened is the witch people had the black market. They produced the materials, and so they had everything they needed. The poor people had a popular basket. They got their cooking oil, they got their matches, they got their, you know, their basics. The middle sectors suffered. I was a middle sector because I was an outsider. And you would see a line and you would rush into that line hoping that maybe it was cooking oil, because the whole time I was there, I think I mainly ate dulce de leche, which is a horribly sweet product, but it was always available. But you go in a grocery store, there'd be nothing on the shelves. But what that does is it angers all the middle sectors, have pressure within the Allende government to take over more industries, to nationalize more. Well, then you're beginning to hit the national owners, what is sometimes known as the national bourgeoisie, the small capitalists, the people who could have gone either way, but they suffered the most. And what we're seeing now is a form of it, because there's all these shortages. People are getting tired of all this. They're refusing to wear masks. But that, too, was not quite enough to bring fascism in. You need the Proud Boys. And the Proud Boys was major in Chile. It was called Fatherland and Liberty. And the CIA, AFIELD, and the International Trade Secretariat completely funded it. And worse, they funded it through the National Association of Manufacturers. Where is the solidarity in that? But what that meant was the violence in the street begins to polarize people. People who are afraid of violence. And then there's a large group of people, as it was in Chile, who said no to civil war. We will not fight a civil war against the rich people. But the rich people were armed and were engaged in a counter-revolution. They were fighting a civil war. And so if the other side says, no, we don't want anything to do with that, you're going to have a problem. And I see that here. First of all, the violence does polarize people. You know, it takes the wannabe fascists and the wannabe corporados, and they begin to build some unity sectors of the middle class, because the middle class gets scared. And this creates a different balance of forces among the classes. And so that was culminated in the October strike, which you can think of as, say, January 6th.
That was labor historian and University of Indiana professor emeritus, Ruth Needleman. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Rwanda and Uganda's M23 militia have returned to the Democratic Republic of the Congo, once again slaughtering Congolese people to seize territory and plunder their resources. To understand this, we have to return to March 2013 after M23 had been terrorizing DRC's North Kivu province for a year. At that time, the UN Group of Experts on the Democratic Republic of the Congo reported that Rwanda and Uganda, but most of all Rwanda, were commanding and supplying M23. The UN Security Council then created a Combat Force Intervention Brigade within the UN peacekeeping operation to drive them out. Usually, UN peacekeepers' task is simply to protect civilians, but the Combat Intervention Brigade had an unprecedented combat mandate to work with the Congolese army to root out M23. They succeeded under the heroic leadership of Congolese Colonel Mamadou Andala Mustafa, but the, quote, international community, unquote, then engineered a negotiated, quote, peace, unquote, that handed the victory to Rwanda and Uganda, and Colonel Mamadou was tragically assassinated. I asked Maurice Carney, executive director of Friends of the Congo, why this is all happening again. Maurice, the triumph of the Combat Intervention Brigade in driving M23 out of DRC, followed by the quote-unquote negotiated peace, which was actually the victory of M23, was among the most cynical operations I've ever seen. Congolese, South African, and Tanzanian troops died fighting for the Congolese people, only to have their victory snatched away by the so-called international community. But the media just moved on, excepting myself, frankly. They believed what they'd been told, that M23 had been defeated and dispensed with. What does that tell you about the international press covering DRC?
Well, international press covering DRC has been wanting, to say the least. And not just DRC, not just the Congo, but Africa in general, and especially when covering conflicts where Africans presented as savages, you know, who have always fought each other and will continue to do so for the foreseeable future. That's the framework in which the coverage is usually presented, and attention is given to these issues when a public official in the U.S. Gets engaged. Even though the U.S. military, U.S. intelligence apparatus remains engaged, but when president or secretary of state, in case of the M23 at the time, with John Kerry, or call that President Obama had made to Paul Kagame, then the press gets interested. However, there are structural issues that remain in place. And when it comes to why we see this perpetual war of aggression on the part of Rwanda, those structural issues include three items, really. One is impunity. The second is lack of accountability. And the third is lack of justice. And the United States government and its foreign policy play a determinative role in maintaining these three obstacles, which contribute to perpetuating a conflict in the region. The reason why M23 could, quote unquote, disband and none of the major culprits or those who have backed them are brought to book is because the United States wants it that way. And when it comes to holding Paul Kagame accountable, the U.S., since the International Criminal Tribunal in Rwanda, has blocked, intervened, prevented any kind of evidence to be brought against Kagame or any kind of trials or any kind of accountability. So that's a major part of the reason why we see not only Kagame skirting justice, but the entities that he backed, such as the M23 or the CNDP before that, or Alliance for Democratic Force for Liberation of Congo. It's a rinse and repeat since 1996. But the core issue is those two agents of U.S. empire, Paul Kagame of Rwanda, Yoweri Museveni of Uganda, they've been able to pretty much have their way in the Congo, the Great Lakes region of Africa, and East Africa, and the Horn of Africa, for that matter, for the past quarter century. And the United States blocks any attempt to hold them to account or to bring them to justice.
This time, the UN Group of Experts came to the same conclusion they came to in 2013 and 2014 in a report released on August 4th. Since then, they've been a bit more to the point, generating headlines like, quote, Rwanda wants the world to look away from ties to M23 rebels, though too many of these reports still say that Rwanda and Uganda are alleged or believed to be behind M23, when everyone's known that for more than 10 years.
Or they say Rwanda denies backing M23. Yeah. That's the most repeated one, which on the face of it's true. They deny it, but they're denying something that's factual and evidence-based. I don't know how they arrive at printing that stuff.
Okay, but
I do, because when you have the U.S. allies, agents of U.S. imperialism, committing crimes against humanity, mass crimes, the press, the U.S. press pretty much falls in line. It's for the most part, they're critical of states and actors that are in the crosshairs of the United States. Those who act on behalf of the United States, who function as agents or allies, the press usually treats with kid gloves. You know, the so-called fourth estate is just an extended apparatus of the empire. So it really depends on where the empire's interests are, the strategic interests of the empire, that play a major role in shaping not only what the corporate media covers, but how it covers it. So it's not that surprising, really.
Okay, now you're probably going to give me the same answer, but the UN investigators have not pulled their punches. They come right out and say that Rwanda and Uganda are commanding the M23, but still M23 returns and the slaughter and plunder go on and on. Why are the UN investigators' very precise conclusions ignored as well?
That's been the case for over two decades. I mean, the UN, from the 2010 mapping report, has a database of the perpetrators of crimes against humanity, the war crimes. And even in that report said that if these crimes are brought in front of a competent court, it may constitute crimes of genocide. So the UN has all of that. That hasn't changed in terms of the veracity in their reports and the abundance of evidence. The question is, when you have an empire that's behind you and can run interference, though it doesn't matter how much evidence you have, it doesn't matter the accumulation of data over decades, if the U.S. does not want Paul Kagame or Yoweri Museveni to account, that's not going to happen. I remember at the publishing of the UN report in 2010, even the French were complaining that then U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Susan Rice, was blocking any action and basically covering for Paul Kagame. So when you are on the side of the empire, and this is a thing that folks really need to understand, you get cover, you get political cover, you get diplomatic cover, and you get a free hand to commit mass crimes, crimes against humanity with impunity. And that's the benefit that the Kagames and Musevenis have of being agents of the empire.
Where is Congolese President Felix Tshisekedi right now in this picture? He claims to be accusing Rwanda and trying to fight Rwanda and demanding that the rest of the world condemn Rwanda. What's his real game?
And he is, and that's his pedigree coming out of the opposition. He had been saying that before he got into the presidency. When he first got into the presidency, he was lovey-dovey with Kagame, going to Kigali, visiting the genocide memorial, holding hands with Kagame and smiling. But he has to also respond to domestic pressure. And when your own population is making it clear that they're victims of an aggressor nation, you have to respond to that. So I see his statements now as responding to that. But even in his policies and trying to present to the Congolese people that being a part of the East African community is somehow a path to bringing about peace and stability in the Congo is preposterous. Anyone could have told him that that's not going to deliver whatever it is that he thought he was looking for. That East African community plan is pretty much in alignment with the Nicolas Sarkozy, former French leader, and Herman Cohen, the former Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, who's now a lobbyist. They had proposed Congo being part of the East African community and proposed economic integration with Rwanda, Uganda, and others in the East. But when you have the East African community that's made up of two of the aggressor nations against the Congolese people, how can you expect some kind of solution to come from that direction? It's not plausible at all. It's not viable. So, but in any case, I see him responding to domestic pressure, of course, from the Congolese people. You have Dr. Denis Mukwege, the Nobel Peace Prize laureate, who's been very vocal, very clear about the mapping report, and the prescriptions in it need to be implemented. And the prescriptions in it call for the holding of Rwanda and Uganda, but Rwanda in particular, accountable for the crimes that they've committed in the Congo.
Is there a solution? What direction do the Congolese people need to go in here?
The Congolese people need to organize in themselves in a way that they control and determine their own affairs, where they are able to choose their own leaders, where the United States and other Western powers are not the difference makers. What we've seen throughout the quote-unquote independence of the Congo from 1960 to the present is that ultimately it's the so-called great powers, the former colonial powers, the empire, that ultimately determines who leads the Congo. So Congolese people have to organize themselves to the point where they determine who lead the Congo. They did that in successfully did that in 1960. It didn't last long. It lasted months when they elected Patrice Lumumba's party, the Congolese National Movement, which led to Lumumba being the prime minister. But he was quickly dispensed of, and so was the apparatus that put him in place. So since that time, the Congolese really haven't regained any kind of control over their electoral affairs or over the country, the affairs of the country itself. So that's really the big challenge, to organize themselves in a way where they can control and determine their own affairs and where they can put in place leaders that truly represent their interests.
Okay, so of course the solution is in the hands of the Congolese people, but is there anything we in the West can do to help?
Absolutely. Like what you're doing in telling the truth, shining light on what underlies the instability, the conflict, the plunder that we see in the Congo. That's vital for us who are in the empire and have access to resources to put the truth out there. And not just put the truth out there so it's in the air, but so that we can organize and educate the U.S. citizens, to mobilize U.S. citizens, organize U.S. citizens, to put pressure on the U.S. government for its foreign policy, not only around the Congo and the Great Lakes region in Africa, but its foreign policy overall, where it seeks full spectrum domination, where it's a war first policy, where it sponsors and supports the most despicable leaders that you can find on the planet, Museveni and Kagame among them. So this is a part and of a cloth, let's say, the weaving of a cloth where the United States foreign policy is anti-democratic, in support of authoritarian figures, militarized, in support of plunder and the pilfering of natural resources of other nations. So this story of the Congo fits into that narrative, and the U.S. citizens need to know this, that the U.S. foreign policy is not only destructive in Latin America or in Europe or in Asia, but also in the heart of the African continent.
That was Maurice Carney, Executive Director of Friends of the Congo, on the return of M23 in DRC. According to the Mississippi AFL-CIO's president and secretary treasurer, Robert Schaffer, the dirty water crisis in Jackson, Mississippi is part of a long history of state corruption and deterioration of the state's infrastructure. It's also connected to public workers' working conditions. Pacifica's Steve Seltzer spoke to Robert Schaffer.
2 years ago, when we had the bad winter, we had main water lines that bursted. And this 100 years old, you know what I mean? And it's the system has not been kept up. When I know there's a lot of federal money over the years that's come in, but you really don't never know what happened to it. I'm similar to the TANF thing we got going on. A lot of the stuff that the state controls, like state offices and stuff, have been taken out of Hinds County and put in the outer line counties, like maybe Rankin in Madison County. And what we're seeing is a lot of the businesses are leaving because they're having to raise the tax base to try to struggle to keep the city going, and which in turn makes the businesses say, hey, I'm not staying. I'm going somewhere else. A lot of them have. People are leaving in droves. And one of the reasons is the water. When you can't drink the water, it comes out of the faucet. When it gets to the point where you can't take a bath in it, where the officials is telling you, you know, boil your water before you use it. It's got pretty bad. And this has been ongoing for, I don't know, the last boil water notice has been on for several weeks. Now, they do have, as I understand it, the pressure up. It was so bad a week or so ago that buildings with like a second or third floor didn't have enough water pressure to flush your commodes. In fact, the state capitol has got porta potties around it, if that tells you something.
And this is the state capital of Jackson, Mississippi. You have, yes, a governor there, and millions of dollars have been going to Mississippi from the federal government. The federal government has been contacted, the EPA. Where's the money gone that has gone to Mississippi to help the people of Jackson get clean running water?
Lord, I don't know. You know, and I think that's a question that the feds need to help answer. You know, since the feds sent the money in, I think they're obligated to find out what happened to it, because it's definitely not on the ground for the residents of Jackson, Mississippi.
And I understand a lot of the money that is going into Mississippi from the federal government has to go through the state government. What has happened with some of that money that's coming in from the federal government when it gets to Mississippi?
The part I know about is what I've read in the paper, the TANF money and all, you know. And
what was that about?
They just basically put it where they want it. And they just, the guy that's kind of checks that, I can't think of the office's name, but it's the state auditor, brought up some issues on it and had a law firm working on it. And he was about to start serving subpoenas on people, and they fired him. The governor, as I understand it, fired the lawyer. And so now they're getting another law firm, and I would assume to not ask so many questions. But I think in the meantime that the feds are getting involved, so maybe we'll get the questions answered.
So you're saying that, I mean, what happened in this incident is federal money was supposed to go to poor people in Mississippi, and instead it ended up going to rich people and going to their private projects their own projects.
As I understand it, they built quite a bit of money, maybe somewhere around $1 million went to the Southern Mississippi University to build some kind of facility down there. Now, this is stuff I'm reading in the paper. I don't have access to the records, and then I understand that Brent Farr got a bunch of money to give speeches that he didn't make, but I also understand he paid it back. But now they're fussing over the interest on it.
Well, what does it say about the way the state's being run, that money which is supposed to be going to poor people ends up going to rich people in Mississippi?
It's the plantation mentality. I mean, hell, it's been going on for 100 years. I mean, you know, it's just, there was a time, you know, when we had a decent deal going on. You know, I mean, I'm with the labor union. We could go over there and discuss our issues and sometimes get a little bit of something done for workers. But now it's better if they don't even see my face over there, because they're not going to do anything to help labor or working people, which is the same.
And the union, Mississippi and Texas, some of these states, out the fact that they're, you know, that they don't have unions, that it's open shop and it's freedom. What you have a different idea of what's going on there?
Well, I mean, it's just, you know, they call it right to work. Hell, everybody's got the right to work. It makes it very difficult to join a union in Mississippi because they put so much money and the chambers and all of those people will help the companies fight the unions off. Let me give you an example of a state law here in Mississippi, and you can look it up. It's Kelly versus Mississippi Valley Gas, where they can discharge you for filing a workers' comp claim. Now, that's state law.
So if you file a workers' comp claim, you can be fired for that?
Under the state law. I'm not saying that there are very many people do that. But that went to the Supreme Court of Mississippi, and that was a ruling years ago.
And what was the basis of firing somebody for filing a workers' comp complaint?
Hell, I mean, it keeps their workers' comp insurance down. If you don't file a claim, I mean, hell, pretty simple. You don't have very much of a workers' comp insurance. Same as Texas. Texas has got a law where you can waive having workers' comp insurance. Because my son was working in Texas on a construction job, and he called me, said, Dad, they're telling me if I don't sign this sheet waiving workers' comp, they're going to fire me. So it's little laws like that they got on the books all over the South that really destroy the workers. And stuff like that helps keep the unions out.
What percentage of workers are organized?
In a state, I would say 5-6%, maybe 6%. Could be right around that. There's a chart on the Internet I look at a lot, you know. We're 34th in the nation, or were the last time I looked, you know. A lot of them, you know, is lower than we are, North Carolina and South Carolina, as a percentage of the workers.
So if all this federal money is going into Mississippi, and apparently it's not being used properly, where has the federal government been?
Well, that's the point. I think they just kind of write us off and say, hell, we'll just give them some money to keep your mouth shut, you know, and let it go.
And you think that's the reason this thing with the water has gone on as long as it has? Because the EPA has known about it. Previous federal government agencies have known about it. It's been going on there for years.
Right. And I think they just ignore it. I mean, you know, I mean, they got bigger fish to fry, I guess. But I mean, I hope all this stuff coming out that we'll get some attention down here and at least find out who's stealing the money.
And the United States is spending a lot of money, billions for the Ukraine, billions around the world. What do you think about the fact that we can't even have safe drinking water in the United States at this point?
It don't excite me because I've been living through it so many years. You know what I mean? I guess it's just become a standard. But there's places, we had several years ago when Obama run the first time, we had a lot of people come in from the national office, AFL-CIO office, and we sent them up in the Delta, you know, knocking on doors. I mean, you know, really, I mean, and one guy come back and he told me, said, man, I've been to Cambodia, and hell, it's in better shape in this damn state in certain places. But then you got your nice places, you know. I mean, you know, you got your places they take you to or show you, but they don't take you to the places where the real deal is.
And a similar problem in a different way happened in Flint, Michigan. They were privatizing the water system, and they put bad water, which poisoned people and also destroyed the piping system. It seems there's a kind of a history of this thing going on.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is neglect, and I'm not blaming the current administration. It's been going on for years. This taking this money from the welfare people, the TANF money, I think they've kind of went off the deep end doing that. You know what I mean? It's one thing to ignore a water system, but when you got children, and say the governor, you know, where you sign up to get Medicaid, he refuses to do that. Several of the southern states have refused to do that, get the extra help on Medicaid.
So we're talking about taking care of children, this resources so they can have a life.
Yeah, and you know, I just wish some good investigative reporter would come to Jackson and spend a week or two, and just I can show them a part of it, and I can hook them up with people that can show them the rest of it.
That was Robert Schaffer, President and Secretary Treasurer of the Mississippi AFL-CIO, speaking to Pacifica's Steve Seltzer. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. At the end of 2021, the United States had 93 commercial nuclear reactors at 55 nuclear power plants in 28 states. Biden and the Democrats' new infrastructure bill, also known as the Inflation Reduction Act, makes millions of dollars available to increase the life of these aging reactors. In California, Governor Gavin Newsom and the majority Democratic legislature passed a bill to extend the life of two reactors at the Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant in San Luis Obispo for 5 years each. The language in the bill was not released until August 18, and the legislature voted for it nearly unanimously in the early morning of September 1. On top of the federal subsidies, the bill provides the private utility Pacific Gas and Electric with $1.4 billion of state money to keep the plant open. The plant is built on the San Andreas Fault, where an earthquake could create another Fukushima-like disaster. On August 29, the Coalition for Nuclear Safety and Committee to Bridge the Gap participated in a press conference to announce their plans to challenge the bill. We hear first from Kathy Iwani of the Coalition for Nuclear Safety.
I am co-founder of Coalition for Nuclear Safety. I also have two daughters. Governor Newsom's proposal, Senate Bill 846, will be voted on tomorrow night. If passed, it will extend operations at Diablo Canyon Nuclear Facility. This is an outrage to Californians seeking reliable and safe energy for our state. Don't fall for the false claim that we'll experience blackouts without Diablo Canyon online. Diablo Canyon is not a dependable power source. According to NRC Commission data, Diablo averages one or both reactors being shut down 40% of every year. Extending the life of Diablo Canyon actually increases our risk for blackouts. Newsom knows that battery storage of our renewable energy is the answer in sunny California. And it's a travesty that Newsom hasn't prepared adequately enough for the severe weather events and climate change that we're experiencing by investing in appropriate battery storage to coincide with the legal and previously approved closure of Diablo Canyon in 2025. Battery storage and solar power my home and my car. It's widely known that storage will more than cover any loss from Diablo's closure. It gets worse. A sneaky solar tax has been added to this bill. Ratepayers will be charged a new fee based on gross energy consumption, including solar energy that powers solar users' homes and their batteries. Taxing the sun to pay for nuclear power discourages clean energy usage, and Gavin Newsom knows it. Newsom's plan grants $1.4 million as a forgivable loan from Californians to PG&E and exempts the convicted corporate felon from state safety regulations. There's nothing forgivable about this idea. When profits are privatized and losses are absorbed by the public without any concern for safety, you end up like Japan, a country which has paid dearly for its human error-ridden Fukushima disaster. I know, I witnessed the Fukushima triple nuclear meltdowns in real time and subsequently evacuated my family from Japan after 25 years of living there, raising a family, creating community. I watched as Japanese politicians prioritized relationships with TEPCO, the utility managing nuclear reactors in Fukushima, over listening to repeated warning signs from nuclear engineers the world over and activists alike. So what happens when you witness something like this? Citizens' dissenting voices are silenced. Distrust in government institutions is rampant. Cancer and radiation exposure-induced illnesses are censored in media, and the economy continues to tank. Do you see the parallels here with Gavin Newsom and PG&E? It's time to wake up. Currently, there is no federal plan to store our nation's radioactive waste. Letting Diablo run beyond its current licenses would add to the hundreds of tons of more high-level waste, lethal for hundreds of generations, to that already stored on site, allowing more waste to pile up at Diablo with no plan to store it safely into perpetuity, simply hands this nuclear nightmare waste problem to our next generation. It's irresponsible and it's an embarrassment for California. As a mother, I urge you all to hold your representatives accountable to vote no on Newsom's SB 846. California can keep Diablo on track to close in 2025.
Next, Daniel Hirsch of Committee to Bridge the Gap.
The governor put into print at 7:56 on Sunday night a bill to extend the life of the aging and decrepit Diablo Canyon nuclear plant. He did that because the Constitution requires 3 days advance notice before there can be a vote, and this was to be jammed through so that there could be almost no scrutiny of such an extraordinarily, potentially catastrophic action. I want to explain for a moment why it is so monumental. Inside each of the reactors at Diablo Canyon, there is the equivalent of 1,000 times the long-lived radioactivity of the Hiroshima bomb. In technical terms, there are about 15 billion curies of radioactivity inside each reactor, meaning that there are about 500 billion emissions of radiation a second. The only way that the public is protected, that radioactivity stays inside the core. And the only way that happens is if it's constantly cooled. So if an earthquake occurs, if there is sabotage or a terrorist attack, if a worker makes the wrong decision, we can have a release of an extraordinary amount of radioactivity. Essentially a Fukushima on the California coast, but unlike Fukushima where the wind blew most of the radioactivity out to sea, the winds would bring the radioactivity inland to Central Valley or to Southern California or Northern California, depending on which way the wind blows. Diablo was built based on PG&E's assertion that there were no active earthquake faults within about 30 kilometers of the site. Jesus. The local community group that intervened wanted to put on an expert witness in the hearings to demonstrate that there were faults nearby, and PG&E in its wisdom objected, and the licensing board voted 2-1 to prohibit that testimony. They got the license, and a few months later, Hoskins and Griffiths published their paper showing that there was an active earthquake fault called the Hosgri Fault just offshore, capable of an earthquake far larger than the plant was designed to withstand. PG&E initially denied it and eventually had to admit to it, but by that time, 80% of the plant was completed. And rather than upgrade the plant or abandon it, they just asked the NRC essentially for a waiver to allow a plant to be built with an exception for the Hosgri Fault. That, by a vote of 3-2, was allowed by the NRC. Two courageous commissioners, Victor Galinsky and Peter Bradford, objected. If there had been one more vote, there would not have been the Diablo Canyon plant built at all. But PG&E said, don't worry, there won't be any more faults found. But then the San Luis Bay fault was discovered nearby, and the Osos fault was discovered nearby. And then most troubling, the Shoreline Fault was discovered, which is within 600 meters of the plant and about 300 meters from the plant intakes. And these faults are capable of earthquakes larger than the plant was designed to withstand. It gets worse. PG&E claimed that there were no connections between these faults, that the faults are connected, the longer the fault, generally the more earthquake shaking can occur. Finally, they now have had to admit that there could be a joint rupture along the Hosgri, San Simeon, San Gregorio fault zone, which runs from south of the reactors to north of San Francisco. So they began with the claim of no active faults within 30 kilometers and no interconnections. And now it's known that there are 4 nearby faults and several interconnections.
That was Kathy Iwani of the Coalition for Nuclear Safety and Daniel Hirsch of Committee to Bridge the Gap on their opposition to extending the life of the 2 reactors at California's Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant. And that concludes today's edition of COVID Race and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by Steve Seltzer and engineered by Polina Vasiliev. Our executive producers are Akua Holt, Polina Vasiliev, and Steve Seltzer. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. Thanks for listening.